Who, me? What? Yeah. I'm here. Hi. Welcome to the show. This is the Scott Horton Show. That's me. Thanks for tuning in. Hope everybody had a good weekend. I had a great weekend. Thanks for asking. I assume you were asking. Even if quietly. My weekend was great. On Saturday, I went to the big FFF thing. The Future Freedom Foundation, Jacob Hornberger put it on, and it was Glenn Greenwald, Radley Balco, and Ron Paul, who gave great talks about the police state, the war on drugs, and the surveillance state, and then Ron Paul basically gave us his libertarianism stump speech, so all around anti-everything, and then I really appreciate that he kept coming back to liberty's a total package, man. You guys got to get with, real study of libertarianism. Opposing the drug war is great. Opposing the terror war is great. But this is all under the auspices of the greater war on liberty. The greater war of government against all. And then, so he kept coming back to you. You got to learn your natural rights theory. You got to study Austrian economics. Economics. I was told I can't call it economics anymore. What the hell? I always did. Anyway, great speech by Dr. Ron Paul. And then Greenwald and Balco were also both great. And it was a great thing. And I saw some friends there. Oh, and I... Geez, quite a few people came up and said hi to me and that they were fans and friends of the show, including one person who I hope to be interviewing here on the show. Did I tell you guys about this? I may have mentioned this to you, that I read this article about, as best I remember it, this old Republican Party matriarch from Houston. And she's decided that it's the rest of her life's mission, and she's apparently in her 90s now. But it's her mission to get the Republicans to legalize pot in Texas. And I think this is very important. Obviously, it's a very steep hill to climb with, you know, law and order and all that crap. However, it's always most effective to undermine the right and their big government policies by attacking them from the right. So a bunch of hippies saying, yeah, but we like smoking pot is not very convincing to a Republican. But if you can attack them from the right about the growth of big government and bureaucracy and violations of our rights in order to enforce the drug war, the money wasted, the cost to the overall economy, and if they're Democrats, people who might vote for them, is probably a better argument for the Democrats, I guess. The Republicans, I don't know. But anyway, the waste of money. And then, yeah, I think also, if they want to bring in Protestant Jesus into it too, that it's just not the Christian thing to do, to lock people up for smoking pot. Just doesn't make any sense. And look at all the, the real criminals who are let out of prison because there are drug offenders taking up their space, or real crimes that don't get solved because all the incentive is going out and solving drug crimes instead. Pot crimes especially. And so anyway, that was cool. So a lady that worked for her introduced herself and said, you know, she was a fan of the show and she works for this lady that I'd read this great article about. Isn't that cool? So she's going to come on the show. And she actually said, what's the lady's name, I guess? Do I have it? It's RAMP is the organization, Republicans Against Marijuana Prohibition. And I forget the old lady's name. But she said that she's a great interview, too. She might be 90, but she's great for an interview. So I might try to interview that lady. I never even really considered it. But that sounds like a good idea to me. And then a whole bunch of other people. I've forgotten that I had Twittered back and forth with a guy where I told him, yeah, I'll bring my skateboard, man. We'll go ride. And then so he brought his skateboard, but then I didn't bring mine. I was with other friends, and they're not skaters anymore. But that was cool. And then quite a few other people, a handful, half a dozen more people, something, came up and said hi to me and that kind of thing. So it's really nice to know that people listen to the show and like it and stuff like that. You know, I don't know. I basically sit here alone just assuming that there's a bunch of you guys out there, but I don't know. And, yeah, if you're listening live right now on Monday, then thanks for not assuming that I just sailed away or something when you saw that my website was down all weekend. It's still down. Actually, it was back up for a minute, but then it was showing us a page from 2013. That was the backup server. Apparently, it was last backed up 2 years ago. But, so, yeah, no, it still ain't working. But anyway, Sneaker's working on it, and so it'll all be all right. And then that'll be the next Kickstarter. Maybe I really should have done that one first. We need new servers, bad. Sneaker said to me, he said, "Don't say I didn't warn you that this thing is falling apart, man." He couldn't even get it to restart. He's going to go and take the hard drives out of it and back them up onto something else, hopefully. Save all the data and put them on something else and make that go instead. Yeah, no, things completely had it. The primary server. So, anyway, I guess, Well, that brings me to the Kickstarter thing. I started sending out some of the rewards. Some Coburn books have gone out. I have a stack of Philip Drew books that are going out, and, quite a few silver commodity discs as well, but, I kind of was waiting to get some more emails back from people of their mailing addresses, but then my server, and therefore my email too, has been down all weekend long. In fact, if you really need to get a hold of me, you could email me scott@antiwar.com, that'll still work. But I'm expecting a flood of emails to come in once the server gets back up and going. And then at that point, I should have probably all the addresses I need to go ahead and get to the post office and send out the rewards that you guys are due for donating to the Kickstarter, the YouTube Kickstarter. And I guess I need to write Matt's name on my hand so I remember to call him later about the next Kickstarter for the server. All right. Well, anyway. So yeah, the FFF thing was cool. I finally got to meet Radley Balco, so I hope I'll be able to have him on the show sometime soon. I told you guys about his should be Pulitzer Prize winning work on, the bite mark racket, the, prosecutor, the state's witnesses, the professional state's witnesses that go around reading palms, basically with their nonsense and putting innocent people in prison. You know, for the money. And, boy, he just journalistically crucifies them in a massive, what, 4 or 5-part series or something that he did for the Washington Post on this. And, in fact, I saw a tweet that said he's got another one coming out. Anyway, that's the least of it. He's the greatest expert on the militarization of the police and wrongful convictions for all different kinds of reasons and stuff. Anyway, so he's going to be on the show. And, yeah. Server problems, Kickstarter thing, I mentioned that. Okay, good. So, let's see, couple of minutes. So here, let me just say this about the Hillary Clinton, that way I can dispense with it. And then when we get back, we gotta talk about, the Israeli Prime Minister and the Iran deal. And then, obviously, we've got very important police state coverage. And then the great Marcy Wheeler's gonna be on the show to talk about the Boston attack and the, trial. And then Gareth will join us at the end of the show to talk about his thorough debunking of the possible military dimensions, the smoking laptop, the alleged studies that seem to implicate Iran in nuclear weapons research. And so that's going on later in the show as well. Is that the drum? Good. Oh, good. I'm out of time to talk about Hillary, so I just won't. Here's what I'll say about her. She's Philip Drew, administrator. The story of tomorrow, today. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here, and I'm so excited about Commodity Discs from CommodityDiscs.com.
They're 1 ounce silver pieces with a QR code engraved on the back side. Scan the code with your phone and get the instant spot price. Commodity discs are paving the way forward for the alternative currency community in America and around the world. The QR code commodity disc. Technology has now finally made a real free market silver currency viable. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one free. That's commoditydiscs.com. In America today, teachers, cops, judges, and other so-called public servants make far more than the average taxpayer. And their pensions? Well, if the people knew, they'd join us. That's where you come in. Taxpayers United of America is embarking on a great new project to train activists how to take on the parasites in your communities. The entire process, from prying loose the facts to disseminating the truth to the people. The next of these great workshops is Saturday, April 11th in Las Vegas. It's just $15. For more information, go to taxpayersunited.org/govpensions.
All right, guys, welcome back. That was the break. This is the show. All right. Did you see this? In Haaretz, Netanyahu told Cabinet, our biggest fear is that Iran will honor the nuclear deal. You don't say. This is by Barak Ravid. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said at a recent meeting of the Security Cabinet that if a comprehensive nuclear agreement between Iran and the six world powers is indeed signed by the June 30th deadline, the greatest concern is that Tehran will fully implement it without violations, two senior Israeli officials said. All right, great. Thank you. I don't even have a joke. I just let there be a second for you guys to think about that and have your own little laugh. The meeting of the Security Cabinet was called on short notice on April 3rd, a few hours before the Passover Seder. Seder, I guess. Isn't it Seder? Seder. The evening before, Iran and the six powers had announced it. Oh, man, I got in trouble last time for saying it wrong. Lausanne? No, that ain't right. That city in Switzerland where they met. That they had reached a framework agreement on Iran's nuclear program and that negotiations over a comprehensive agreement would continue until June 30th. The Security Cabinet meeting was called after a harsh phone call between Netanyahu and U.S. President Barack Obama over the agreement with Tehran. Two senior Israeli officials, who are familiar with the details of the meeting but asked to remain anonymous, said a good deal of the three-hour meeting was spent on ministers letting off steam over the nuclear deal the way the U.S. conducted itself in the negotiations with Iran, which they know because they were spying on the whole thing, as reported in the Wall Street Journal. Anyway, according to the two senior officials, Netanyahu said during the meeting that he feared that the, quote, Iranians will keep to every letter in the agreement, if indeed one is signed at the end of June. One official said, Netanyahu said at the meeting that it would be impossible to catch the Iranians cheating simply because they will not break the agreement. Netanyahu also told the ministers that in 10 to 15 years, when the main clauses of the agreement expire, most of the sanctions will be lifted, and the Iranians will show that they met all their obligations. They will then receive a Kashrut certificate from the international community. I don't know what that means, but I guess like a clean bill of health. Which will see Iran as a normal country from which there is nothing to fear. Under such circumstances, the Prime Minister said, it will be very difficult, if not impossible, to persuade the world powers to keep up their monitoring of Iran's nuclear program, not to mention imposing new sanctions if concerns arise that Iran has gone back to developing a secret nuclear program for military purposes. That's a huge assumption in the word back there, since they never did have a secret nuclear weapons program in the first place. You see how easy it is to smuggle a giant false premise right into an article? Oh, I'm plagiarizing the use of the word smuggle there from someone on Twitter. They use that. I like that. Sorry for plagiarizing. It's not really intellectual property. I don't believe in that, but should give credit where it's due to whoever that stranger was that used the term smuggle. Talk about how they sneak and place a premise right in a paragraph without ever having to even make it seem like they might need to prove it. Just bring it up in another context that easily. But anyway, the main point is that, do you get it? That's the joke. Netanyahu, the prime minister of scaremongering on the planet Earth about Iran's nuclear program, says his worry is that they will implement the deal perfectly, that they'll finish disproving the rest of the possible military dimensions, that they will change their Iraq reactor to a light water reactor, which produces plutonium waste. And, it, you know, its waste product is plutonium, but so polluted with other isotopes that it's basically impossible to refine it into fuel for an actual weapon. And they don't have that facility anyway, and they're not going to have one. They're going to limit their their uranium enrichment to electricity grade 3.5%, uranium 235.67, whatever, far below weapons grade. And they promise to keep their stockpiles at extraordinarily low levels so that they're not ready to re-enrich it to a higher grade sooner and this kind of thing. And they'll do this for 10, for 15 years. That relations with Iran will normalize between the European Union, obviously between Russia and China, who have gone along with these UN sanctions, and even with the Americans. But meanwhile, lurking all along in the background, the evil secret Ayatollahs will have their evil secret plan to then, once the deal is over, and everybody totally likes them again because of all the money everybody's making trading back and forth, then they'll sneak up on us with their super secret weapons program. Because, I don't know, they'll just unsign the additional protocol and start a big fight, but then no one will want to fight with them about it anymore. And then they'll make a bomb, and then they'll maybe attack Israel or just embolden Hezbollah, as he told Jeffrey Goldberg back in 2012. Well, you know, we're not afraid of a first strike. That's stupid. But we are afraid that Hezbollah will be emboldened if they know that their friend, Iran, has a nuke. They will be able to better resist our aggression, basically, is what he's saying. So there you go. Man, I should print this out. I should, you know what you got to do, man. Here's how you read Haaretz and get around their paywall. You got to find the print version of something, and then you can smuggle your way right past their paywall by adding the number at the end of the URL to a print version URL from an old article. Just replace the number code at the end, and blam, you get the printer version. It's great. I hope I didn't just ruin that for everybody. Anyway, so there you go. Netanyahu told Cabinet, our biggest fear is that Iran will honor the nuclear deal. So back in 2012, Netanyahu told Jeffrey Goldberg, no, don't be stupid. We're not worried that they're going to, you know, get a nuke and then use it on us. We blast them off the face of the earth. Everybody knows that. We got German submarines with H-bombs on them. That was back then. An emboldened Hezbollah was the worst threat he could come up with at that point. And now he's on the record telling his cabinet, who then turned around and told the media, his fear is that Iran will honor the nuclear deal perfectly for the next 10 to 15 years, and then they'll make a nuke. Maybe. But they could have a gun-type nuke in a year right now, really. If they set about doing it, why aren't they doing it? We're complacent enough to sign this deal. How more complacent could we be?
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. It's about time I got Marcy Wheeler back on the show to talk about something or another. The brilliant Marcy Wheeler, a.k.a. Empty Wheel, online at emptywheel.net. And you can also follow her on Twitter at Empty Wheel, too. And so, yeah, welcome back to the show. How are you, Marcy?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Need to turn you up here a little bit. Hey, you know, I was thinking I have kind of a moral hazard with you. Like bankers who know that they can make bad business bets and it doesn't matter because they'll always get bailed out. I kind of did not pay any attention to the Boston trial thing at all because I thought, well, I'll just talk with Marcy about it and she'll fill me in once it's over. So that's this. So yeah, you got this great article here at emptywheel.net. The other possible whys behind the Boston Marathon attack. So what all are still open questions after the conviction of Bomber Jr. here?
Well, let me take a step back and say that the trial was there are two phases of the trial. The first, which we're done with, is finding him guilty. The second, which is going to start later in the week after the anniversary and after the marathon and so on, is
the sentence.
Going to figure out whether or not he should be killed. Mm-hmm. And we'll get a completely different set of evidence in the second half, which the defense will have a lot more say over. So,
okay.
And that's important because in the first half, what the government tried to do was imply that everything that led up to the attack could have involved Jahar, and also implied that Jahar was this big bad jihadist when he definitely was listening to jihadist propaganda, but he was also listening to a lot of rap. There was this wonderful moment in the trial where the FBI got up and interpreted all of his tweets only to have shown by the defense that not only were they misinterpreting them, but they were making big mistakes. They hadn't even clicked through on his links. They were interpreting, what's the name of that Comedy Central guy? Tosh, as a jihadist, rap music jihadist. They confused Grozny with Mecca. You know, so just really bad testimony, like really ignorant testimony about his tweets, which is what they used to argue that he was a jihadist, which is not to say he wasn't. It's just to say that through the entire first phase of the trial, the government went to some lengths to retell the story that they always tell about terrorist trials, which is that big bad jihadists radicalized, big R radicalized, by Anwar al-Awlaki. Mm-hmm. And they were largely successful at telling that story, but that also meant that they also tried to downplay certain outstanding questions and certain evidentiary questions, the biggest of which is where the bombs came from. They showed that there was a bunch of tools in the apartment in Cambridge, which is where Tamerlan lived. They showed the most interesting explosive was not the explosives used in the bomb, but nitroglycerin, which was stronger than what they used in the bomb, but they didn't explain where that went. Hmm. But what they didn't find in either the apartment or in Jahar's dorm room is the dust, the black powder that would have come from the firecrackers, which is almost impossible to mask, especially given how cluttered the Cambridge apartment was. So we should believe that at the very least, they didn't make the bombs in the Cambridge apartment where once the FBI claimed they had made the bombs. There were a couple of different pressure cooker bombs, one thrown in Watertown, and that was a kind of straight bomb like you could make if you were following Inspire magazine, which is what the government wanted you to believe all of the bombs were based on. The two set off at the race had remote controlled detonators, and that's not a strictly followed Inspire recipe? And the government never answered that question. There were also two pressure cookers. The government did a pressure cooker dragnet. So they got the, if you bought, Scott, I doubt you have, but if you bought a pressure cooker between, between July 2012 and April 2013, I may have the dates wrong, but if you bought a Frager Elite pressure cooker from Macy's, then you're going to be an FBI dragnet for the rest of your life. Because they collected the records of everyone in the United States who had bought one of these pressure cookers, they showed that three of the ones bought in Massachusetts were bought with cash, and they were able to show two of those had some tie to Tamerlan, which was a crazy tie, which I can get back to. But they were never able to show that the third pressure cooker turned into a bomb had been purchased by anybody with a tie to Tamerlan, or that a pressure cooker that was found in the house and, you know, in the Cambridge apartment, and the implication is that that's what Tamerlan was testing off of. They never explained where those two pressure cookers came from, or whether maybe those were the two that we know to have been purchased in Boston. Then we don't know where the pressure cookers blown up during the marathon were. So in other words, incomplete story about the smoking gun, or the smoking bomb, as it were. And that's a big one.
Yeah, well, and now, so is there much doubt that the older brother made the bomb? Or I guess if they don't know where it was made, they really don't know who all made it at all.
Right. There were some gloves found in a car used by him, but also used by other members of the family, that had that was one of the few places they found that powder, the powder that you would expect to find wherever the bombs were made. So that suggests that Tamerlan may have been involved in it, but not at the house, not at the Cambridge apartment. I think it's very safe to argue that the bombs thrown at Watertown were made by one or both of the brothers. One of those, by the way, is the elbow pipe bomb that Inspire also has a recipe for, and the reporters were very impressed. They're like, wow, that's just like the Inspire recipe. And it's like, well, yeah, but that's a pipe bomb. That's not the pressure cooker that went off at the race and killed three and maimed hundreds, right?
And there's no other narrative of how Tamerlan could have been taught how to make those in any other time.
No, and there's weird part. Let me give it, because this is one of my weirdest, this is one of my favorite weird parts of the trial. So to prove that, or to suggest that Tamerlan had bought two pressure cookers, they showed that a portable GPS that they found in the hijacked Mercedes, okay, so that the brothers brought with them, had also been basically been in Boston where the pressure cookers were purchased. So the idea is that Tamerlan brought his portable GPS device with him to buy pressure cookers in Boston, and then brought this portable GPS device in their getaway car. Right? Their getaway car, Scott. They want you to believe that this not entirely stupid terrorist brought a GPS device to their getaway car.
Well, maybe he's just really bad with directions.
Which they would have hijacked specifically to get rid of the car that the FBI knew they had. And then the other weird thing about this story is that the purchase in Boston that they have sort of tied to Tamerlan, was made with cash. Why would he pay cash in May for two pressure cookers if he planned on being dead in April? And if he was going to bring a GPS with him to buy the pressure cookers anyway, why? This guy was not that stupid. That doesn't make any sense.
Well, so what do you think it means?
I don't know, but I think that I don't know. I actually don't know. I mean, I think there are lots of theories out there that need to be entertained, but I don't know, what the story is, Masha Gessen just came out with a book that says that she's got people who confirmed to her that Tamerlan was an informant for the FBI, which is irrelevant to how he planned the attack. I mean, it's clear that the brothers did the attack. I want to make that clear. I'm not suggesting that, you know, Blackwater did the attack and they blamed it on the brothers. Not going. But the question is, where did he make the bomb? Who was he working for when he made the bomb?
Yeah. And how well the FBI knew him after questioning him. All right, well, so Sanford and Son plan means we got to take this break. But we'll be right back, y'all, with the great Empty Wheel, Marcy Wheeler, emptywheel.net, for this great article, The Other Possible Whys Behind the Boston Marathon Attack.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
All right, guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I got Marcy Wheeler on the line. Emptywheel.net is her website. And we're talking about the Boston attack. And, you know, there's something fishy about, you know, what all's going on behind the scenes here and what led to the attack. And I think people have had some questions all along. And in your article here, you start with a piece by a cop. In the Boston Globe, asking questions about the FBI, and one that jumped out at a lot of people right away about how they ended up having to admit that they had questioned this guy in the past, and yet it took them days to admit that they recognized him from the pictures, or maybe they still claim they never did.
They claim never to have recognized him. That's the problem, is mm-hmm. that you'll recall, so the attack happens on the 15th. They've got pictures within a day showing the brothers at least as suspects. And yet it wasn't until the 18th when the government released these pictures saying, we need your help, which set off this manhunt, which set off the shooting, which set off, you know,
the whole lockdown of the city.
The lockdown of the city on the 19th. So the most basic question, which is what that unnamed cop asked, is, why did the FBI guys, I mean, the FBI interviewed Tamerlan and members of his family a couple of times in 2011. Why did the people who conducted those interviews not recognize these pictures? I mean, that's the most basic level. Why is it that days after the FBI had solid pictures for the suspects, did the FBI instead release these pictures and set up this manhunt rather than say, oh gosh, that's the guy I interviewed as a terrorist suspect back in 2011. Didn't happen. 2 years earlier. So that's the most basic question. And then subsequent questions thereafter. I mean, I mentioned earlier, the defense alleged in a filing that the FBI had approached, Tamerlan to be an informant. They said that they were going to target the Russian community. Possible, definitely. So that's one story. And as I said, Marcia,
well, it seems likely at least that they had tried, right? Whether or not he necessarily went along with them.
Right.
But, you know, it's funny
right.
because.
But then there's the other possibility, the other informant possibility, which is that he was involved in the drug, in the drug war, I almost said. He was involved in the drug trade. There was that murder, that triple murder in 2011 in Waltham, Massachusetts, involving his best friend. Everyone involved was involved in drugs, so it looked like a drug hit. There were allegations that there were some corrupt Watertown cops, again, involved in these drug rings. So there's another possibility for him to become an informant. Was he a drug informant? And in that case, it might have been the DEA, not FBI. And I've shown there's good reason to believe, we know, for example, that the NSA collected on Tamerlan before the attack, but didn't read that stuff until after the attack. There's good reason to believe that when somebody's an informant, their collections are what's called defeated, so that others won't then start chasing down your FBI handler because you call your FBI handler all the time. So in other words, if somebody's an informant, they may be hidden in NSA's dragnets precisely because they are an informant. And so that might explain that. The other thing that I found really interesting is the testimony at the trial narrowly dodged a lot of issues or narrowly didn't talk about
them. Can you stop there for a second? I wanted to go back to the picture real quick about, yeah. I mean, the most obvious question is why didn't they recognize him? But then the sort of secondary question to that might be, why did they lie and pretend that they didn't recognize him when, hey, we had questioned this guy before, but we didn't have enough on him to, you know, put a chip in his butt or anything. So what are we going to do? We had to let him go. And then, yeah, so this happened. That's not that bad of an explanation. Would that be the only thing that they were, would it have to be worse than that for them to spin it, you think?
It's the FBI, Scott. Can you or I really get in the head of the FBI and think the way they think? I don't think so. I don't think that's in our nature.
I mean, I guess just clamp down on the story altogether and figure out what to tell them later would be the first order business.
Right, you're saying that the FBI should have come forward and said, gosh, we got a tip from Russia and as a result interviewed this guy. That had to come out as a leak rather than, and it came out as a leak after this manhunt had come off. So maybe they tried to get away with that. Maybe they tried to suppress that information as well.
Yeah.
And that's a great, you know, I can't answer that.
I mean, because it seems like for the public interest and everything, they would say, this is the guy we're looking for. His name is Tamerlane, you know, or whatever, right? They could have, and instead they decided to clamp down on that. It's highly significant, and I'm sorry because there's so many important things to go over here, but it seems like a really big deal that they would apparently, allegedly by me, pretend that they didn't know this guy. Rather than just fail to figure out that they did know him.
Right. They should have come as soon as they ID'd him on the 19th. They should have said, golly, you know, this guy. I mean, and here, okay, now I'm going to pretend I'm an FBI person. The FBI would say, well, we couldn't tell you that the Russians gave us a tip because that would piss off Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, but they wouldn't have to say their source. They would just have to say, we know who this guy is. This is who he is. And we'll come up with our excuse for how this happened after we knew his name later. But, things first, right? Innocent people have been killed and maimed here. What the hell?
Right. Well, didn't happen. So yeah, at the very least, that's suspect. Then the allegations that he was approached to be an informant. Then the fact that, at least according to some people involved or some people tied to that 2011 triple murder, he wasn't adequately investigated for it and he acted weird after that. And then, you know, add that in with his trip to Russia that they couldn't find. I've got new questions about that because he was actually moved into an inactive position, which again would make sense if he were an informant. But as a result, Customs and Border Patrol did not question him. And there's at least reason to believe there's reason to believe that Inspire magazine was either on his laptop that he brought with him to Russia or had been on his laptop and then deleted off, but in such a way that it would still have been available if people had wanted to scan his laptop. So they could have legally at the border taken his laptop in 2012 when he went to Russia and found that he had Inspire magazine on it. And then they would have had another reason to investigate him. That didn't happen either.
Well, now, so does it seem from at least kind of one take that he was somehow radicalized by an al-Qaeda outfit in Dagestan or something? They're the ones who recruited him and had him do this. He just decided to start reading al-Awlaki and al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula's magazine online and came up with this himself?
Well, he was definitely reading Inspire before he went to Dagestan. But because that came out in the trial, he in fact the at 6 a.m. on the morning he left for Dagestan, he or somebody else uploaded a copy of the complete Inspire onto Jahar's computer. So January 21st, 2012, that transfer takes place via a thumb drive, and he appears to have at some point either brought a translation or tried to write his own translation of Inspire magazine into Russian, which is sort of an interesting point. But I don't know about that fact. But one other question I have coming out of the trial is just as a tiny detail, the brothers, Jahar had two phones. He had a prepaid T-Mobile cell phone that he got the day before the attack. And he had had an AT&T iPhone on a friends and family plan with a bunch of his Central Asian buddies that from college. And that one had his particular phone on that friends and family plan had lapsed for non-payment. And by the morning of April 19th, 2013, the government was using his friends and family plan to enter his buddy's apartment without a warrant. So they already had a lot of detail about his AT&T phone. What's interesting is that in the trial, the government hid what time on the 19th they learned from they officially learned from T-Mobile that the brothers, each of their prepaid T-Mobile phones were in their name. They weren't even burners, really. They weren't hiding that they were their phones, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what's interesting is the government didn't advance any plausible explanation for how they found the phones and when they found the phones. We know that Jahar had destroyed both of the phones by the time by the time he was picked up by the government on April 18th. And all I'm trying to say with this is that probably they found the phones via other means. And one way they might have done that is with location tracking that they don't want to tell us about. And so, the fact that there's this weirdness about the phones, remember they claimed that they used the NSA dragnet to check into the brothers' relations. Except at the same time, a bunch of anonymous people are saying they can't use the NSA dragnet, doesn't collect any cell phone data. Well, that's all they had. That's all the brothers had. And according to their claims, they wouldn't have collected any of this T-Mobile data because T-Mobile is one of the providers that's not directly, providing to the government. So there's a lot of fishiness with the phone records, which leads me to believe they're hiding some phone tracking on the brothers that they don't want to know. And that would be another way that they could have ID'd them before the big manhunt.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, so, I'm sorry to ask you to speculate, but I guess, I don't know what the hell. I will anyway. And you say whatever you want. Does this seem to you like one of those Trevor Aronson, Terror Factory type plots? Because, usually it's a disturbed, young, naive kind of idiot that they trick into saying he loves Osama or hitting the red button or something stupid like that. But the Tamerlane guy doesn't seem like the kind of guy that the FBI agents would try to play in that way necessarily to me. I don't know. But I wonder whether you think that it's one of the likely possibilities that the origin of this plot was one of these FBI entrapments, but they just, screwed up and it went off rogue, that kind of thing.
I don't think so. And the reasons I don't think so is because A, he's smarter than the guys they try and entrap.
Mm-hmm.
And B, for a variety of reasons, it sounds like the addition of the Russian factor and whatever that is. Remember that their uncle had ties to the CIA and therefore presumably to intelligence collection in Chechnya, that involves the drug trade, right? So I'm actually in the middle of writing a post about David Headley, and I think when you get into this overlap between drugs and terrorists, that's when the government loses it. When their desires for informants may supersede their desire to entrap young terrorist defendants. And I just think there's enough other factors in this case. I mean, look, Tamerlane was real. I think he may not have made the bombs, but he was a fairly competent young man, which is more than most of the guys that the FBI entraps. I mean, most of them are mentally ill and most of them aren't mixed martial art people, don't have they're not drug dealers. They don't have a network of criminal accomplices already. And that's what these brothers had, both of them, frankly. Mm-hmm. And so I think that already makes them somewhat more sophisticated, than the average guy entrapped by the FBI.
Right. Well, yeah, no, I definitely agree with that, but it's interesting, though. I mean, to have a hole as huge as a likely or, very possible you know, unindicted co-conspirator out there who actually made those bombs that did the damage. I mean, who could it have been? I don't know. I'm not trying to say, oh, I have to assume it was the FBI themselves or someone else working for them or what. I don't know. But that's a pretty big hole for the FBI and the Justice Department to decide, well, let's go ahead with this prosecution. And I guess leave the rest of the case unsolved. There was a really interesting detail that
the prosecutor succeeded in not letting the defense introduce, which is that, you know, the government tried to pretend that one of these computers, which was clearly Tamerlan's, wasn't just Tamerlan's. That was the only computer that was encrypted. That was the computer where he first downloaded Inspire, but there was also on that Russian language materials about bomb making. And we don't know whether the Russian language materials explained the details of the bombs that the Inspire recipe could not have, which is the remote control stuff. We know that Tamerlan bought the remote control stuff, the car, you know, the car toy parts that they used to set off the bombs, but we don't know whether he's the one who set that up. The prosecution succeeded in preventing us from learning what those Russian language bombing materials were. And that might point to more of an answer.
Yep, very interesting stuff. Well, thank you very much for your great work on this and your time on the show explaining it. I sure learned a lot.
Absolutely, good to be on.
All right, see you later.
Take care, bye-bye.
All right, y'all, that's the great Marcy Wheeler, Empty Wheel, at emptywheel.net and on Twitter at Empty Wheel. We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first. And just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
Hey guys, how's things? I don't need those. Hurt my ears anyway. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. So that was Marcy Wheeler. Sorry, yeah, I kept her into the top of the hour break there because I wanted to know more things. Anyway, I want to say I think it's good that they're opening up to Cuba. And it's funny to see people attacking Barack Obama like the worst thing that he ever did was end the ridiculous Cold War against Cuba. You kidding me? Yes, it is a communist dictatorship. But, yes, yeah, so? What, America only does business with democracies? Is that it? Because I could think of a couple of exceptions to that. Anyway, and then, yeah, Jeb Bush was saying that Obama is bestowing legitimacy onto Raul Castro. When, of course, no matter how much like the Bushist Barack Obama is, the Republicans would always have us believe that he's just like Castro. How is Barack Obama going to get, who has no legitimacy whatsoever, which I agree with, but not for identity politics reasons like them. How could he bestow legitimacy he doesn't have onto Raul Castro, of all people? And anyway, what does any of that have to do with it? Some make-believe concept like legitimacy of government leaders. Anyway, they're broadly supported in Cuba, as horrible as that sounds. And I'm not saying that the people have been free to decide or anything like that, but there's one thing that the Cuban people have ever liked about Castro, that he kept them independent from America's domination, that he stood up to the Americans and kept them out. And it's been a heavy cost that they've paid beyond just suffering under a communist system anyway. Imagine a whole society run on rationing. Jesus. But anyway. So, yeah, I guess the only possible negative, I mean, the positives are obvious. For us, especially, we get to ratchet down our militarism just a little bit. I'll take a tenth of a degree of a ratcheting down of American militarism on an issue as important as Cuba, one of our nearest neighbor countries. And the standard of living, obviously, will go up for the people of Cuba, the end of the embargo. And I guess they're not completely done ending the embargo, but still. So that is all to the good, of course. The only worry would be that they turn it into what it used to be under Batista and the, you know, right-wing dictators before the left-wing dictators, which was basically all just corrupt. And letting foreigners come in and basically take control of the island. So, anyway, I'm not for protectionism and all of that, but then again, the American megacorporations, they're all on the dole. They're a bunch of reds themselves, you might have noticed, so it's not quite a fair fight. But I don't know, I guess what ain't for sale ain't for sale. We'll see. But anyway, the newsworthy sense of the story, I guess, how in the world is this supposed to be a scandal that America's ending the Cold War with Cuba? Give me a break. I'm trying to use this against Obama. Boy, Republicans really suck bad if that's the worst that they can say about this psychopathic killer. Does nothing but turn the world over upside down and shake the hell out of it according to the Ledeen Doctrine. Every day of his presidency for 6 years straight now. Best thing that they can think of to criticize him for is trying to make peace. Anyway, so that's all I got to say about that. But yeah, so now the police state stuff. So there's a plethora of news stories here. Of course, you saw in the Washington Post, right? Fairfax jail inmate in taser death was shackled. A mentally ill woman who was restrained in handcuffs in her cell. They gave her the Guantanamo violent cell extraction riot squad treatment. I forgot what they call it. Anyway, they went in there. They say that she initially cooperated with the deputies and placed her hands through the cell door food slot and agreed to be handcuffed. But then once they put the cuffs on her, she kind of flipped out. And so then they just beat the crap out of her in white full body biohazard suits. I guess you gotta use them for something, huh? Oh yeah, she's a crazy person. Let's dress up in full biohazard suits as we pummel the crap out of her. And with gas masks too. Nice. Very nice. Very THX-1138 for you there. Kinda like it. And then they electroshock tortured her to death. 450,000 volt shocks from the taser. Strapped her into the chair. Put a mask over her face. And then gave her the electroshock torture with the taser to death. They tortured her to death. There's the headline that the Washington Post will not give it. Deputy sheriffs at the local holding cell. Electroshock torture mentally ill woman to death. Helpless. Mentally ill woman. Armed with nothing. Hands cuffed. Restrained in a chair. But, you know, anyway, that's the cost of civilization and everything, right? Anyway. And then, of course, there's Eric Harris. This is the guy in Tulsa. He's running down the street. The cops tackle him. But then who are the cops beating his ass? One of them is a retired insurance salesman who donated a bunch of money to the local sheriff's department, and they gave him a little shiny costume jewelry badge like a kindergartner and called him a reserve deputy. They're claiming it was an accident, that he meant to grab his taser. But really? What's the indication of that? That they say so? We're supposed to take that as gospel, that it was an accident. Never mind the incompetence that put a 73-year-old out there doing this in the first place. The guy pulled out a gun, shot the guy through the chest. And there he is. He can't believe it. You shot me. I'm shot. I'm shot. Oh, my God. Meanwhile, after they know he's shot and on the ground helpless, the other cop puts his knee right on the back of his head and is just smashing his face into the concrete as hard as he can. And the guy's saying, I'm shot. I'm losing my breath. I lost my breath. And then the other cop says, F word, sorry, it's the radio, your breath. Which is, you know, not all that coherent of a statement as its own hashtag. But it was in direct response, him saying, he's shocked, he can't believe it. I'm shot. I'm losing my breath. F your breath, says the cop as his buddy is crushing the guy's face into the concrete as he dies. They murdered him, humiliated him, mocked him, and brutalized him as he died. And what was his crime? I know you right-wingers are like, yeah, but he was guilty of a crime. What was his crime? He was entrapped into selling somebody a 9mm handgun. And I know you left-wingers are saying, the cops are out of control, the cops are out of control, we need more gun control. And you're looking at the exact result of how gun control plays out in the real world right there. I think both sides of y'all have a lot of serious thinking to do.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
All right, guys. Gareth Porter's coming up to talk about the possible military dimensions and a couple other things, too. Yeah, no, so it's funny. I was thinking of Anthony Gregory told me one time he gave this speech, and at the end of the speech, this kid came up to him and he said, wait, but I'm still confused. You're against taxes and prisons? And Anthony said, well, yeah. Hey, man, no taxes, no prisons. No prisons, no taxes. Get it? Yeah, freedom. See? Mind blown. Wow. Such left and right-wing positions being actually one in the same thing at the same time. And in a good way, too. Not in a goose-stepping way, in a less goose-stepping way. All right. It's that same kind of thing about the gun control trap that got Eric Harris. Oh, he was on probation for having drugs in his pocket one time or some crap. What a bad guy. Boy, now I think all these bad things about him. Meanwhile, he's running down the street in shorts and a t-shirt, if I remember right, with my pictures in my brain. He's unarmed. They're saying it was an accident, and maybe it was. But a 73-year-old reserve deputy, he has a right to bear arms. He has a right to bear a 45 and put a deadly hole right through this man's chest. They'll have the right to mock him as he dies, but he doesn't have the right to sell a 9mm? What the hell is a crime about a 9mm semi-automatic handgun? other than he's a prohibited person. Because he's a black man. And, you know, I don't know, man. I guess I've heard disingenuous right-wingers invoke this argument before. Because they're pretty much kind of, you know, like Larry Pratt. That guy's a racist prick, right? No question about that. But still, he's right that it says in the Dred Scott decision by Chief Justice Taney, whose name I always said wrong, because he spelled it wrong. Put a W in your name then, jerk. Anyway, the Supreme Court Justice who penned and voted and, yeah, the guy behind the Dred Scott decision that said that no black man has a right that a white man is bound to respect. Right? Like, what? The craziest thing that someone could possibly argue, and it's a Supreme Court decision, right? And then, but if you read it, it says, but wait a minute. If they have rights, like a human man has rights, then that would mean that they have the right to bear arms. And I know you're not saying they have a right to bear arms. That's in Dred Scott. Read it yourself. I'm not mischaracterizing it or anything. That is in there. That is how we know that black men don't have rights, according to Chief Justice Taney. Because if they had rights, that would include their right to own a gun. And you hear this all the time. It's even conceded by the civil rights activists saying another unarmed black man shot down. Which, of course, hey, what the hell? I'm not diminishing that, but it just becomes implicit that if a black man was armed, it would only be because he's a violent felon in the middle of committing a crime. But why should we take that for granted? Remember, we were laughing on the show, what, like a year, maybe 2 years ago, when the New York Times ran a thing on Sunday about, hey, guess what? Middle class, that is educated and acceptable black people, sometimes own guns. Can you imagine? This is like the New York Times, you know, whatever is the proper village of Manhattan type people. I'm not from there. I'm a Texan. Talking to each other. Did you know that sometimes black people own guns and it's not for crime committing, but just maybe to protect themselves from the possibility that crimes would be committed against them? Yeah, here they are at the shooting range practicing shooting and then apparently not robbing anyone on the way home. It's all right in there in the New York Times. Look, honey, we're just supposed to assume that black people don't have the right to bear arms. And you know what? It's kind of true, in effect. Because in America, with the layers and layers and layers of gun control laws, how are they applied? Of course, disproportionately against black people. Why? Because they're easier targets. They have less political power. They're less likely to be able to afford a good lawyer or to have a good connection to a family member who has a little bit of pull or could in any way get it on 7 on your side on the local news or do anything to help. And so, here, entrap this guy into selling a gun to you. Hey, man, you think you could find me a gun? Geez, yeah, I guess so. Here's that gun that you needed. Oh, you're under arrest. Now we're going to, you know, put you in prison on a felony for, if you're lucky, not the rest of your life. And I know that liberals imagine, I know they do. I've heard them talk about it. Yeah, all these rich white people with their arsenals of rifles at their houses, it's all dangerous. Is that who you think is getting raided and their guns taken away? Who's getting entrapped, which it is some, I guess, you know? I guess probably especially on the federal level, but meanwhile, all the federal agencies, and you may have heard Karen Greenberg on the show a couple of weeks ago. Oh, no, it was Rebecca Gordon. I'm sorry. Very sorry. Talking about how virtually every federal police agency was in on the gun walking thing, the gun smuggling to the Sinaloa cartel scandal. They were all in on it. These same people who enforce gun laws on the national level. But then on the local and state level, this is no different than prohibiting pot and then persecuting an entire community because whatever percentage of people have a little bit of pot. It's the same percentage or even maybe sometimes a lower percentage than on the rich side of town. But that's just harder for the cops to get away with. And so anyway, for you right-wingers who oppose gun control, this is the effect of gun control. Innocent, unarmed black men or even was armed a few minutes ago. Black men killed to death in the prime of their lives by cops enforcing what you would consider to be absolute violations of rights if they did it in your neighborhood. And liberals should understand that your fantasy about who gets prosecuted in your gun control schemes, all those conservative, rich, white gun owners, is your fantasy, and it doesn't make it real. And maybe it's the reason why you support gun control, but you end up leading to the thing, causing the thing that you're most outraged about these days, and thank God for that part. I'm not mocking that, which is this entire I can't breathe and now F your breath too movement that's going on right now for especially black civil rights, but for everybody's right to not get shot to death by a cop, for Christ's sake. People say judge, jury, and executioner. This guy is supposed to just be first on the list. His job is protecting the rights of the murder suspect. That's his warrant right there. That's his standing warrant. Protect the rights of suspects. Bring them safe and sound to the jail where we can hold them for trial. Oh, also, read Brutal Reality at Slate about police cameras. It's really good. It's about how it dissuades. It's a deterrent from aggression by cops, not just evidence against them later.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more war in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, you guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I got Gareth Porter on the line, writing for Middle East Eye and author of Manufactured Crisis, The Truth About Iran's Nuclear Program. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Gareth?
Hi, Scott. Glad to be back. Thanks.
Very happy to have you here. Lots of stuff to talk about on the show today. The possible military dimensions, which you gave a great talk about on Friday that I watched online at the Israel Lobby conference that Grant Smith put on there, and some other things too. But if it's okay, I wanted to ask you first of all about this right-wing talking point I see going around that says that there is no fatwa. Obama says that the Iranian supreme leader has issued a fatwa against nuclear weapons. And they say, oh, yeah, show me the fatwa. You can't because there is no fatwa. What do you say to that?
That's interesting. I just had a conversation this morning with somebody who raised the same question. And I had not seen the opinion pieces. I assume you're talking about some blog or opinion piece that raised this.
Well, right-wing kooks on Twitter, anyway.
Right. Okay. I said, look, the problem here is that the people who are spouting off about the fatwa have no knowledge whatsoever about the subject, and they're taking advantage of the ignorance of the rest of the reading audience. And the problem is that a fatwa does not depend on being published. Fatwa can take different forms. It can be a speech made by the individual who is issuing the fatwa. It could be in a conversation between the individual and a minister, if it happens to be the supreme leader, as I illustrated in the story that I did for Foreign Policy last December about the fatwa that Ayatollah Khomeini issued on chemical weapons, against chemical weapons as well as nuclear weapons during the Iran-Iraq war. He did give public speeches against nuclear weapons and talked about that issue in public, but he also made it clear to the minister of SEPA, meeting with him twice during the Iran-Iraq war, as I document in that article, saying to him that he could not, that the government could not move ahead with any work on weapons of mass destruction because it was illegal under Islam. Now, you know, that conversation that he had with the minister of SEPA constituted a fatwa. And that is not understood. I realize that there's a general notion that, it has to be written out and published but that's got nothing to do with the truth. And I know now that I need to write something about this. And in fact, in the conversation I was referring to this morning, I said, okay, thanks for mentioning this. I've got to write something, and I will.
Okay, good deal. I wonder, though, can you clarify how widely published this was? I know you have this great article. It's When the Ayatollah Said No to Nukes at foreignpolicy.com. But how widely disseminated was this, you know, ruling or pronouncement by the Ayatollah back then at the time? And then what about, you know, the newer Ayatollah who's been in power since, what, 88 or 89?
Okay, let me just extend, I mean, to sort of continue that point and explain it one bit further. And that is that when you are the supreme leader, as opposed to any other cleric who has a following, who has, you know, the training in Islamic jurisprudence, then any pronouncement that you make that relates to the relationship between a public policy issue, a government policy issue, and Islam is a fatwa, okay? I mean, it is not, you know, how widely it's disseminated. In that case, the fatwa was not disseminated publicly. It was simply communicated, you know, through the government channels to the issue to the minister who had responsibility for the issue. Mm-hmm. But it was still a fatwa; it was still binding, and of course, it prevailed. It was the policy of Iran. In other words,
anyone there who could have been in the position to make weapons of mass destruction, they knew about it, and that's enough.
That's right. I mean, you know, the minister of SEPA had presented a plan to Ayatollah Khomeini, saying, okay, we've got these experts, these groups of experts on all of the issues that relate to our military supply needs in this war against Iraq. And so one of the things or a set of things that he talked to Khomeini about were weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear weapons, chemical weapons, and biological weapons. And he had groups. He proposed groups on all those weapons to at least have the capability to deter the Iraqis, letting them know that they could not get off scot free using weapons of mass destruction against Iran. But Khomeini said no, and that did constitute an absolute Islamic jurisprudential judgment by the supreme leader that was a fatwa.
All right, and then again, that article is When the Ayatollah Said No to Nukes. And now, I guess, because all I'm trying to nail down there is, you know, the idea that someone could dismiss this by saying, well, you know, you have an interview with some guy who claims this, but what's the real proof if it's not written down, that kind of argument?
Well, the real proof is that that did, in fact, constitute the policy. I mean, you know, it is a fact that Iran never used weapons of mass destruction, even though it had the capability to do so. And that's well documented.
But does their political leadership still refer to this fatwa right now and say, yeah, we have a fatwa, everybody knows that kind of thing? Is that their official government position on this?
On this meaning what? What is the...
On nuclear weapons, for example. Or
oh, yeah, absolutely, sure, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, that is still the case. I mean, you know, the fact that it was not disseminated publicly during the Iran-Iraq war is perfectly understandable. I mean, it was not necessary to distribute it publicly.
Sure.
By distributing it publicly, you know, the Iranian government would be communicating to the Iraqis that, you know, they were not going to do anything in response. So that was not a desirable situation from the Iranian point of view.
Sure.
So I think it is, you know, there's a perfectly rational explanation for why they would not have distributed that fatwa during the Iran-Iraq war.
All right. Now, it's already 12:40. I guess just at the very beginning here, let's get into the possible military dimensions. Yeah, sorry for beating that dead horse.
No problem. But let me give me 30 seconds to explain...
I believe that there's
a joke here that needs to be made popular, and I'd like to get credit for it. I think we should all call the possible military dimensions possible military dementia.
Yeah, we could try that.
Try that. See if you get a laugh. I'd like to say
the obvious bogus debunked forgeries that have been debunked for years and years, but that takes
right.
a little time.
Possible military dementia, I like the sound of it. So.
Yeah. It is.
I'm kind of, you know, I'm just joking, but anyway.
I understand. Sorry. I stepped all over your punchline. I see. It was objectively funny.
is objectively funny.
Yeah. So listen, the possible military dimensions. This is a stupid question, but entertain it for me. Thanks. The alleged studies, the smoking laptop, the possible military dimensions. Are these all one and the same thing exactly? Or
no.
Does possible military dimensions includes other things beyond just the alleged studies?
Correct. It does. It includes a raft of alleged intelligence reports and documents, which, you know, I document the fact that virtually all, if not all, of those intelligence reports and the documents or alleged documents did, in fact, come from Israel. I mean, you know, the circumstantial evidence, necessarily circumstantial evidence, is strong in all the cases where these issues have been discussed publicly. I can't guarantee that it's literally true that there's absolutely nothing that they're going to raise with the Iranians that did not originate in Israel. But I think I'm safe in saying that virtually everything at least came from Israel.
Okay, so when we get back from this break, we'll have this whole segment to talk about the possible military dimensions, to go through them and remind me, because the first thing I want to ask you is, which all very quotable, authoritative-type names have cast doubt on the provenance of these things? And also, oh, yeah, the cables, the misinterpreted cables from the book. Yeah. All right, hang tight, everybody. Gareth Porter, more right after this. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Talking with Gareth Porter, again, debunking lies about Iran's nuclear program. Okay, so I'm sorry, man. I may have brought up a whole different subject, Gareth, but you talk in your book, and we've spoken before, about all these intercepts that American intelligence had of orders for dual-use items. And it was a pretty long list. And then when you go and tick off all the items on the list, it's all taken care of and spoken for. Oh, yeah, well, what about the magnets? Well, they're sitting right there on the balancing machine and whatever it was, being used for non-nuclear purposes, just like in all the excuses. They basically proved it. Now, is that part of the possible military dimensions, or was it, or that's a separate group?
It's related to it, and in some way that I can't actually describe to you. I mean, I can't give you any details about that. All I know is that I went to a briefing by Oli Heinonen and David Albright, what was it? I guess it was several weeks ago now. And after the briefing, sort of, you know, I got into a conversation with them, and during the briefing. They were claiming that that there were more items than were covered in the IAEA report, although they weren't specific about what they were. I think they were referring to some of the things that are in the possible military dimensions list that the IAEA is asking Iran to explain, such as the studies of neutron activity, for example. But, you know, I don't trust what they're saying, that these were part of the original telexes. All I know is that they're claiming that, you know, there's a broader list that were part of the telexes. I'll just pass that on to you for what it's worth, which is
sure.
Not much.
Okay, that's fine. All right, so then go ahead then about, I guess do the non-laptop PMDs first and then the rest? And you
well,
got 10 minutes?
The non-laptop PMDs are essentially it involves a set of intelligence documents and reports, which the Israelis passed on to the IAEA 2008-2009, and at least in one case apparently after 2009, because that the one I'm referring to is specifically the intelligence report that there's a cylinder at the Parchin military base, the military technology testing base of Iran, which the IAEA said that an unnamed member state told them, gave them information, was to be used by Iran for, or at least it was appropriate for the use by Iran of testing nuclear weapons, doing nuclear weapons testing of some specific nature. And it all tied in with the high explosives issue. That is the use of high explosives to testing high explosives to use as a detonator for nuclear device.
And now, customarily, IAEA member state is a euphemism for Israel. And even though they're not a member of the NPT and they don't have a safeguards agreement, they're a member of the IAEA in an Adams for Peace kind of way that has nothing to do with the inspection type regimes. But they get to hide behind that when they're the source of the bogus intel.
That is correct. And in regard to this issue, there's no question in my mind, certainly, that all those references to when it is a single member state, now not all the references are to a single member state, but where it is in the November 2011 report, which I hope many of your listeners are familiar with or know about, when it refers to a member state, then that is indeed Israel. The circumstantial evidence in each case is very powerful. And I do talk about that in some detail in my book, at least on three of those documents or intelligence reports.
All right. Now, I was in a email argument with a journalist recently, and I was able to quickly Google up many statements by Mohammed El-Baradei and Robert Kelly and others in a real position to know. Could you add to that list of who do you know who knows? Who said that, or were in the greatest position to know, who said that they had doubts about the origins of the laptop and those alleged studies?
Well, as far as the laptop and the alleged studies both, El-Baradei certainly indicated, as you said, in his memoirs that that they were not authenticated. He did say that the later set of documents, 2008 and later, documents that were passed on by Israel to the IAEA, and that experts, I think as he put it in his memoirs, had said or had looked at them and said they had very serious questions about those documents, suggesting that the questions were related to their authenticity, among other things. Then there have been some press reports, at least one by The Guardian, I think back in 2007. If I'm not mistaken, that quoted unnamed IAEA sources as saying that other senior officials at the IAEA had their doubts about the laptop documents because the other ones had not come out yet. And I do, in fact, have a source, a former IAEA official, who has told me that he personally had very grave doubts about the authenticity of the laptop documents. And so that was a general view outside, at the senior level of the IAEA, outside Ali Heinonen's shop from 2005 to 2010 or 2009 when El-Baradei left.
Mm-hmm. Now, wasn't there even one quote by Ali Heinonen, and he's known as the most hawkish former IAEA official, but didn't he even at one point say, yeah, I guess I agree with the Germans that there are some doubts here, something like that?
I've never seen a quote that sounds like that. He did tell me in an interview that, and maybe this is what you're thinking of, he said, well, I wouldn't say that it's evidence. This is very close to an exact quote. He said, I wouldn't say that it's evidence, the laptop documents. It's simply a lead, is the way he put it to me, which is, a very strange thing for him to say, because he was the one who obviously insisted in 2008 and 2009 on wording in the IAEA documents that said these in the IAEA reports that these documents are quote credible, and sort of pumping them up as good evidence to use in their investigation.
Mm-hmm. All right, and then tell us briefly about the nose cones and some of the other bogus stories in there,
right,
and how you debunked them.
The drawings that were done of the Shahab-3 missile apparently, you know, it looks very much like trying to integrate a nuclear weapon into the payload of the Shahab-3, into the nose cone or the reentry vehicle of the Shahab-3. The very serious problem that that those drawings have is, in terms of credibility and in terms of authenticity, is that it depicts a the reentry vehicle of a missile which the Iranians were no longer working on as of the year 2000. From the year 2000, they were redesigning the original Shahab-3 nose cone or reentry vehicle so that it looked completely different. It no longer had that sort of pointy end, conical look, but rather what they call a baby bottle shape. And the baby bottle shape was, in fact, the one that appeared in the follow-on to the Shahab-3, which they had for a while at least called the Goddard 1, and it was tested for the first time in the summer of 2004. And no one knew before that test that, they, in fact, they had a completely new, redesigned reentry vehicle for what had been the Shahab-3. So clearly, the people who were doing these drawings were unaware of the most fundamental facts about the Iranian missile program, and it is simply totally not credible that these could have been done by an outfit that was hired by the Ministry of Defense or by any part of the Iranian military-industrial complex.
All right. And now, I forget whether you reported about the documented in the alleged studies, quote-unquote documented, experiments in using laser enrichment to create uranium tetrafluoride, a.k.a. green salt.
Yeah, I mean, that was something that they had some technology essentially from Chinese and Russians that they acquired in the 1990s. The IAEA reports are quite explicit about the fact that they only did experiments, I believe it was in 2002, 2003, for a period of 6 months, and that the experiments were a flop. They were only able to get one-third of the level of enrichment that they needed from the laser enrichment, and so they abandoned it after 6 months or so of trying it. And that was it. Mm-hmm. That's all they did.
You know, I don't know if I ever asked you or anybody else if I ever got a easy answer out of this of what would be the point of making uranium tetrafluoride when they already have a facility to make uranium hexafluoride. Would it be just they needed a supposedly a secret alternative way?
Okay, I'm sorry. Now, I thought you were talking about only laser enrichment. That's what I was referring to.
Well, I'm talking about, I think, you know, going more like the conversion from...
Right, the conversion. The conversion technology. That was another part of the laptop documents. It was called a flow chart or something to that effect. And it depicted, you know, the process by which Iran could make tetrafluoride. The problem with one of the problems with the credibility of that is, as you say, that Iran already had picked a technology. They had worked on it for 10 years. They'd experimented on it. They had actually gone ahead and built an entire conversion facility based on that technology. So the idea that they were going to start all over again is just laughable. And I know that the Washington Post did a story in which they quoted some U.S. unnamed intelligence analyst as saying, well, you know, maybe they wanted to have a backup in case blah, 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 blah. But, you know, it makes no sense whatsoever, as the Iranians pointed out to the IAEA at the time.
Right, yeah. The sneak out was always just make-believe anyway. If they ever were going to make nukes, they would just go ahead. They would have to just go ahead, withdraw from the treaty like the North Koreans, and just say, yeah, okay, fine, we're making nukes, at which point they have their conversion facility already.
Right.
Hex is greater than tet.
There's no path to a sneak out that isn't going to be picked up very easily. I mean, you know, they don't have the ability to to sneak out enough uranium to make any difference without it being immediately detected. And the IAEA has said that publicly. The CIA has said that publicly. It's just not, it's not in doubt except in the minds of David Albright and Ollie Heinemann.
Yeah.
And a few other right-wingers.
All right. So what are some other important, and I'm already keeping you over time, so if you got to go, I understand. But if you can, could you take us through another couple of few debunked assertions in there? I know you had them on pretending the mining company was under the umbrella of the military. And
right. I mean, this is, I'll just mention this as the other major case that I really investigated carefully. And, you know, it was the case of an Iranian engineering firm that was named in this green salt, you know, that's another name for that conversion process, the green salt document in the laptop documents. It was the name of this outfit was on the document, and you know, supposedly, therefore, they were a central part of this covert nuclear weapons research process, a research outfit. The problem that I discovered was that the problem with the credibility of that is that they supposedly were doing this this work in 2003, and that they had a contract to do it, which you know, they supposedly had you know, been able to establish that, that this was the outfit that was doing it, but the contract work, the name of the project, which was supposedly part a sub project of something called Project 5.0, was actually a project that did exist. It did exist in reality, but it turns out that the project was a matter of public record. It had been let in two and a half years before this alleged nuclear weapons program even began. It was in 1998, and you know, the earliest date on which this alleged nuclear weapons, covert nuclear weapons program started is 2001. So that just doesn't really quite add up. And I confronted Ollie Heinemann with this discrepancy. First thing he said was, well, who told you that this contract was done in 1998? I said, it's in your report, Mr. Heinemann. It's in the February 2008 report. And then he said, well, you know, we have other information which we didn't publish, which you know, indicts this organization, this engineering firm. So a week later, I talked to him on the phone, and I brought it up again. And this time he just said, well, I don't really have any answer to that question, why there's such a discrepancy.
All right. And now, so all these details, but they're important ones. But the real point is, this is a major sticking point in the current negotiations. We still don't have a
absolutely
final deal.
We have to make that point.
But wait a minute. Now, let me set this up, and you can still answer it however you want. But let me set it up by saying that the White House version of the framework for the deal includes, yeah, and they're going to resolve the possible military dimensions for us, and then so we're good to go.
Right. And you know, they may well have some kind of understanding that, I mean, I'm prepared to accept that there will be a possible military dimensions part of the process by which Iran fulfills its obligations under the agreement. But I can tell you this, I'm quite confident that this is the case, that the Iranians have agreed that they will provide information and access to the best of their ability on all of the issues relating to PMD that the P5 plus one are ready to put on a list and present to them. And, you know, as long as the list is not hundreds of, you know, items, as long as it's a reasonable length. But the Iranian position is going to be that once it has provided the access, once it has provided the information that it can on all of these points, then it's finished. They are not going to be held responsible. They're not going to agree that the IAEA can then simply say that, well, we're not satisfied and prevent them from getting the sanctions relief. And so I think that that at this moment is still an unresolved issue, and that it is, I would guess, the most dangerous, the most threatening aspect of the negotiations that still remains unresolved.
Right. They're being asked to prove a negative.
Yes. Exactly.
They're being asked to, you know, admit that you've been beating your wife by conceding the date to when you allegedly stopped, although we're still not sure of that.
And the point is that they are counting here on the Obama administration basically saying to the IAEA, get it done, don't stand in the way of this agreement being carried out, because the Iranians will take the position publicly that if they are denied the sanctions relief that they deserve under this agreement, because the IAEA plays, you know, funny business with them, that they will withdraw their own cooperation under the agreement. That's going to be the threat, and I think they're quite serious about it because they don't have any choice.
Yeah, you think Obama is going to insist that the IAEA just hurry up and throw out the trash and verify?
Well, my guess is that is the way it's been. You know, obviously not in such simplistic terms, but that's the implication that the Obama administration has left with the Iranians to make it palatable that they agree to put the PMD issue on the table with regard to the implementation of the agreement.
Right. Well, yeah, that's the.
But I suspect the Supreme Leader does not totally trust the United States government, whether it's Obama or anybody else. I mean, he certainly doesn't trust Obama for a very good reason. And that is still somewhat of an ambiguity in regard to the Iranian position here. Whether they will demand more assurances is, I think, part of the problem at this point.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of a catch-22, where the fact that it's mostly a bunch of made-up stuff and worst interpretations of stuff makes it either very easy to resolve then, or makes it impossible
exactly.
to resolve.
Exactly. It's either very easy or impossible. One of the two.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks for coming back on the show. I sure appreciate everything I learned from you, Gareth.
Thanks, Scott.
All right, y'all. That's the great Gareth Porter. He's at Middle East Eye, and this one is from last October, when the Ayatollah said no to nukes. That one's at foreignpolicy.com. And thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.